Ever feel like you're drowning in headlines trying to make sense of the huge shifts happening in the world right now?
Yeah, it can be tough to sort through it all.
Exactly. So today we're doing a deep dive to really get to the bottom of something pretty crucial. We're talking about why the U.S. seems to be pulling back from the global order, the one it basically built after World War II.
It's a big deal, no doubt about it.
For sure. And to help us unpack it, we're turning to Raghuram Rajan's The Breakup. He really digs into how the United States came to, reject the global order it actually created.
It's a fascinating analysis, really gets you thinking.
It does. So Rajan tackles the core questions here. Why this apparent rejection? What does it mean for everyone else, especially with these massive shared problems like climate change and migration? And what can we do going forward?
Big questions.
Right. We'll look at how the idea of globalization has kind of fallen apart, how much tech versus trade is shaking things up, the political fallout, and hopefully some paths forward. So to kick things off, where did this whole shift start to gain traction?
Well, the old agreement, that pro-globalization feeling, especially in the West, it began to crack in the late 90s, early 2000s.
What was happening then?
Emerging economies, they were starting to see real benefits from this interconnected world.
Makes sense.
And Raja's point is, it wasn't a sudden break, more like this gradual erosion of that initial consensus.
Right, and it feels like recent global events have really poured fuel on that fire, haven't they?
Absolutely. The financial crisis, the pandemic, rising geopolitical tensions, all of these acted like, catalysts, pushed the shift further and faster.
Yeah, I see that.
And Rajan points to the evidence, the tangible stuff. Global trade as a percentage of the whole economy, it's been flat since the financial crisis. Think about that. A key part of globalization, the flow of goods and services compared to how much the world's producing, it stalled. Foreign direct investment, down too. And get this, trade restrictions, the things countries impose to limit imports, they've increased tenfold since 2010.
Wow, tenfold. That's a lot. That really shows how things are getting less open, right?
It does.
And you mentioned earlier, this isn't just a U.S. thing, right?
No, that's important. Rajan stresses this isn't solely America going its own way. Other industrialized nations are also rethinking their place in the existing global setup. It suggests there's something bigger going on, not just a U.S. policy change.
Okay, so let's dig into those forces at play here. Jobs are a huge part of the conversation, it seems.
Absolutely. Those solid middle-class jobs, the ones that required moderate skills, their decline has really shaken things up.
Economically and politically, I imagine.
Definitely both. And it's easy, almost instinctive, to blame trade competition for this, That image of factories moving
That's
overseas.
a powerful image. A plant closes here and you hear it's now producing somewhere else.
Exactly. But Rajan argues that while trade's a factor, technological change is the bigger disruptor when it comes to those routine jobs.
Really? So not just factories moving, but the way things are done is changing.
Right. Think about software like TurboTax. It automated so much of what accountants used to do. Or automation in manufacturing itself. Even in countries known for more manual labor, like cell phone assembly in India, automation's taking hold.
Interesting.
And with AI getting more sophisticated, this job displacement, it's probably going to intensify.
That's a different kind of challenge to tackle. It's easier to, I don't know, get angry at a foreign competitor than at a machine, right?
That's the political reality. Those foreign producers, they're an easier target, less controversial, maybe.
Right, you can point a finger.
And all this technological progress, it's fueling even more intense competition for the manufacturing jobs that remain globally.
How so? I always thought developed countries had this big advantage in manufacturing, didn't they?
They did, historically. Better education, skilled workforce, good infrastructure, access to capital, strong intellectual property protections, all those things led to higher productivity. They could absorb those higher labor costs. But Rajan's point is this gap is shrinking.
Emerging economies are catching up.
And sometimes even surpassing them in certain areas.
Like what?
He uses electric vehicles as an example. Chinese EVs are often not just cheaper, but better in some ways because their design incorporated all this digital tech from the start. It wasn't adapted from older gas-powered designs.
So they were built for the future, basically.
Exactly. Then there's Apple, outsourcing manufacturing to companies like Foxconn in the emerging world. Cost considerations are driving that, lower labor costs, advanced technology available there.
So we've got this economic earthquake happening, and obviously that's going to have aftershocks in the political world, right?
For sure. Rajan highlights how the decline in status for men in those traditional middle-class jobs, those jobs that gave you security and standing, it's a big political factor. Often those were held by majority groups too. And as those jobs disappear, well, it creates tension.
Yeah, and it's not like there are a ton of new good jobs just waiting to replace them, are there?
No, and the new ones that are emerging, they often require different skills, more intellectual, less physical. So more women are able to compete, which is great overall, but it can contribute to that feeling of displacement for some.
Right, the world's changing, and not everyone feels like they're part of that change.
Exactly. And Rajan points to voting patterns, you know, the AP Votecast survey data. It showed a higher percentage of white men, Latino men, black men voting for Trump compared to women in those same groups. While lots of things influence votes, Rajan suggests this difference could reflect more dissatisfaction with the way things are among those specific groups.
Right. If you feel like you're being left behind, you might be more open to someone promising change, even radical change.
That's the idea. And it's not simple to just create a bunch of new, good-paying jobs. Rajan makes this comparison to what happened in Britain during the first Industrial Revolution. Yeah, he talks about Engels' pause. That was a period where wages were basically stagnant for decades before they finally started to rise. He's saying that even though unemployment rates might look okay in developed countries, there's this lack of confidence. People don't feel secure.
So things feel shaky even if the numbers don't necessarily show it.
Exactly. And if it's shaky in developed nations, imagine the situation in the developing world.
That's got to be even tougher.
Rajan argues it is. Workers in poorer countries, they're facing a really tough situation. Commodity prices, which are often central to their economies, they've been pretty flat. And that old path to development, the one based on manufacturing and exports, the model that worked for a lot of emerging markets, it's getting harder to follow.
Why is that?
Protectionism, the automation we talked about, and just fierce global competition.
So the way up is getting blocked off.
Kind of, yeah. And then you add climate change, conflicts disrupting traditional livelihoods like agriculture. It gets pretty grim. The pandemic piled on more financial strain, leading to more migration, more people trying to reach developed countries.
Which brings us to immigration, a very hot button issue.
It is. Rajan gets that countries worry about being overwhelmed by immigration, and there's this desire for assimilation, for people to adapt to the existing culture.
Those aren't necessarily bad things to want.
No, but those worries are loudest among the left behind, the people who see immigrants as competition, especially for jobs.
But isn't it more complicated than that?
Often, yeah. Hmm. Rajan points out that immigrants frequently do jobs that native-born populations don't want or can't do. And historically, immigration has brought a lot of energy, new ideas, economic growth.
I can see that.
With aging populations and, frankly, financial troubles in many Western countries, smart immigration policies could be really important for stability in the long run.
But the fear factor around immigration is a big obstacle, isn't it?
Oh, huge. In a world that feels uncertain and even hostile, even countries like Canada, which have generally been open to immigration, are struggling with this fear of being overwhelmed. Makes it really hard to make good, rational decisions about immigration.
So we have all this going on economically, socially. How are politicians responding to it all?
Well, Rajan calls it the politics of polarization. Basically, when you don't have good solutions to these deep problems, you blame someone else, block any change, and throw some money at your core supporters.
That's familiar.
The classic playbook. And who gets blamed? Globalist elites, diversity initiatives, big corporations, foreign manufacturers, you name it.
The usual suspects.
Yeah. And Rajan admits there might be some truth to some of it, like Chinese IP theft, that's real. But he also puts things in context.
How so?
He brings up Hajun Chang, the economist. Chang argues that lots of developed countries did similar things when they were industrializing, maybe not on the same scale, but the idea is there. And China's now creating its own IP, building its own protections. It's not a one-way street anymore.
So it's not as black and white as some people make it out to be?
Exactly. Same with government subsidies. Yeah, China's subsidies are a concern, especially how they created this glut in solar cells and EVs. But Rajan reminds us that subsidies happen everywhere. Pandemic relief, bailing out banks, industrial policies. It's not just a China thing.
Governments do it all the time.
The problem isn't subsidies themselves. It's the scale, how transparent they are, and if they actually work. And history shows that these huge, centrally planned industrial policies often flop in the long run.
So the blame game and protectionism, those aren't really solutions.
Rajan's pretty clear they're not. He uses tariffs on Chinese solar panels as an example. They didn't bring back tons of U.S. manufacturing jobs, mostly because of automation. China just routed its exports through other countries, and U.S. consumers ended up paying more. He also makes a point about trade deficits. They're linked to how much a government spends and earns, meaning focusing only on trade is treating a symptom, not the disease.
And this all gets even trickier with the rising tension between big powers, right?
Yay, for sure. Rivalry breeds distrust. Everyone gets suspicious. Businesses prioritize secure supply chains over efficiency, and even everyday products start to look like strategic assets or even weapons. More protectionism, framed as national security. That dream of bringing back manufacturing jobs with tariffs, it's probably not happening. Protectionism usually means higher prices for consumers, domestic industries struggle to export, less spending overall, and incomes drop elsewhere, which ultimately hurts job creation here at home too. The Great Depression, that's a stark reminder of what can happen when protectionism runs wild.
Not a happy picture. But Rajan does offer some hope, right? What can we do?
He does. He believes voters will eventually get tired of the polarization, those leaders who promise big things but don't deliver. He points to shifts in the UK and Poland, where voters went for more moderate leaders, opening the door for sensible changes. Also, a lot of emerging and developing nations still want an open world. They could team up, form coalitions of the willing to build a new, better system.
So some reason for optimism there. But what should we actually be doing?
Domestically, Rajan says we have to invest in people, give them the skills for the future job market. He likes the models in Switzerland and Scandinavia, where local governments, businesses, nonprofits, and schools work together. The idea is to handle things at the lowest level where they can be done effectively.
Makes sense. And globally.
Three big areas. First, climate change. We need action among willing nations, recognizing that different countries can do different things. Developed countries and advanced emerging economies, they should lead on cutting emissions and providing financial help to less developed nations. We need better ways to measure and track emissions, stronger national commitments, better carbon trading, no tariffs on green goods, and more sharing of green tech know-how. Developing countries should focus on adapting to climate change and making sure new investments are environmentally sound, using the money from developed countries.
So, a practical approach to a global problem. What's the second area?
Services trade. Technology lets us do so much remotely now. Think telemedicine, consulting, finance, design. Global trade in services is already outpacing trade in goods, and it has huge potential if we break down barriers. Developed economies like the US and the UK often have an edge here, but it's a big opportunity for developing economies too. We need global agreements on things like recognizing professional qualifications, data privacy, and building digital infrastructure. The benefits. More income in developing countries without people having to emigrate, less inequality in developed countries because of competition and services, and more sustainable growth overall.
Sounds promising. And the third area?
Reforming those big global institutions. Rajan says the IMF and the WTO aren't working as well as they could, partly because some powerful developed countries are getting more protectionist. He suggests making them more relevant, maybe even creating new ones, like a World Immigration Organization to handle, well, immigration.
That's a big idea.
It is. Specifically for the IMF, Rajan proposes shifting power away from the executive board, which is heavily influenced by the U.S. and its allies. Instead, give more power to professional managers to decide on things like loans, while the board focuses on the big picture. The goal is to build trust and make sure decisions aren't just political. Similar changes could happen at the World Bank and WTO. Rajan says the U.S. wants other countries to step up, but it needs to share some of its power, too.
Okay, so to recap, the big question here is, the U.S. built the post-World War II global order. Now it seems to be having second thoughts. As we've talked about, the reasons are complex and the stakes are really high.
Totally. You've got technology changing jobs, global trade and competition shifting, political polarization everywhere, and developing countries drifting apart. But Rajan lays out some paths forward, like finding local solutions, cooperating on climate change, opening up services trade, and fixing those global institutions.
It's a lot to think about, but it shows how interconnected we are, even though things feel fragmented right now.
Exactly. And that brings us to a final thought for you to ponder. Globalization has woven us all together, for better or worse. So how might this push for separation, with all its costs, end up changing what countries prioritize and how they cooperate in ways we can't predict right now? It's something to keep in mind as we try to figure out what comes next.